Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. If you are a parent like me, of a high school senior or junior, you probably know exactly what I mean when I say admissions anxiety. I am gripping the table as I say it. Parents have nightmares about it. Student applicants carry it around every day like the weight of an extra backpack. But what if that anxiety isn't just about getting in, but is actually a sign of a bigger problem plaguing higher education? Joining me here in Studio 3 to explore that question is Paul Tough. He's a journalist, writer, and author of the new book, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. Paul, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So I want to start with a quick reading, actually, from the book, if that's okay. It's actually from the first chapter. You're meeting with a high school student, Shannon Torres. She's a low-income student from New York City who's waiting to hear whether or not she's been accepted to her dream school at Penn.
Yeah, so we're sitting together on a bench in West Harlem, and she's going to get the news in the next half hour or so. So I'll read now from that chapter. Shannon had begun crying for real now, quietly, swiping her fingers up under her glasses to catch the tears before they fell. I asked her why she was so upset even before she had received any news, good or bad. And she said she wasn't sure, but she tried to explain. School has always been my thing, she said slowly. I've been working so hard for the past... How long have I been in school? I've been in school since I was 3. She rubbed her nose on the sleeve of her hoodie. So you take the thing that you've been best at your entire life, and you have someone, or in this case, a group of people, sitting in a circle, who have not met you personally, who are determining if you're deserving. Shannon could picture them there in the Penn admissions department, paging through her application, her grades and her test scores and her essay and her recommendation letters, and rendering a judgment on who they thought she really was. And then they tell you that it's not enough or that it's not good enough, she said, or that someone's score on a test could possibly measure up to all those years of hard work that you put yourself through, that you chose to put yourself through. Now she was crying harder. And I did choose it. I love school. I love what I do. It's something that I don't force myself to do. I come to school because it's me. It's just who I am.
So I had you start with that probably for the same reason you started with it, opening the book. You can really feel the anxiety and the tremendous pressure that this poor kid, Shannon, is dealing with from herself, friends, family, teachers. We're not going to reveal what happens to her, whether or not she gets into Penn. But were you surprised at the impact that she was experiencing, you know, in that moment?
In some ways, I was. Yeah. I mean, it was a gripping moment to be with her, and I was grateful to her for sharing that moment with me. But I at the same time, I'd known Shannon at this point for a while. I'd met her a few other times, and I knew how much pressure she had put on herself and the system had put on her for this decision to go the right way. You know, I think there is definitely a psychological pressure that students, all sorts of students, but especially students from low-income families can put on themselves in this situation. But I think she was also responding to some very real pressures in the economy. You know, for a student like her, first-generation student, no one in her family had gone to college, from a low-income, single-parent family in the South Bronx, for her to get admission to one of these selective colleges would change her life, would give her opportunities beyond what she could imagine. And I think the way she felt was that for young people like her from her corner of the South Bronx, you don't get a lot of second chances. This was her one shot.
You know, one of the things that I struggled with in reading the book was we all know the script. We know what we're supposed to say. We are supposed to say, isn't just about getting in. You know, wherever you go, you're going to be great. You know, this is all going to be fine. You're going to go to college. But you say not exactly true. And you talk about some really high stakes, not just about whether you get in, but where you go.
Yeah, that was how it felt for me. So I was sitting there with her on the bench, and I wanted to give her that sort of reassuring message. And I think it's important to say that for high-income students, for affluent students, where you go matters a whole lot less. But I had just come back on the day that I was sitting there with Shannon from California, where I'd spent a few days embedded in the lab of an economist then at Stanford, now at Harvard, named Raj Chetty, who, along with his colleagues, had done this remarkable study called the Mobility Report Card Study.
Part of his Equality of Opportunity Project.
Exactly. That demonstrated for the first time with clear data how much much of a difference going to a highly selective institution matters.
And now, when you say a difference, what kind of difference?
Well, so one data point that he found is for students who go to what he calls Ivy Plus institutions, meaning the Ivy League and other similarly selective colleges, students who go to those institutions have a 1 in 5 chance of being in early adulthood in the top 1% of earners, of getting really rich pretty quickly. And students at colleges just one step down, the super selective colleges that aren't quite in the Ivy League, they have a 1 in 11 chance, almost half as much of a chance. And students who go to community college, a 1 in 300 chance. So that selectivity matters, and it especially matters for low-income students. Another finding of Raj Chetty's is that when two students from very different backgrounds go to the same institution, the gap between them almost entirely disappears just in those 4 years. And in early adulthood, they're earning almost exactly the same amount.
So does that put special responsibility on the most elite institutions to admit more low-income students, make it more possible to go to school? What's our moral burden here? If we know that information is true, what is our systemic obligation here?
Well, you would think that they would feel that moral obligation. But the third finding that Raj and his colleagues came up with is that these highly selective institutions are admitting very few students like Shannon. So at Ivy Plus institutions, almost 3/4 of students are from the top economic quintile, and just 2 or 3 or 4% are from the bottom economic
quintile. Is that all
quintile.
Just about ability to pay?
I think at those institutions, it's not as much about ability to pay because they have these enormous endowments that they can admit anybody they want. I think it is about it's partly about their focus on test scores, and test scores correlate highly with family income, much more so than high school GPA. If you are judging students only by their test scores, you're going to admit a class like these schools do that has a lot more high income students and a lot fewer low income students. There are other advantages, certainly ability to pay tuition, early decision. There are lots of points in the admission system that favor high-income students over low-income students.
So you had some discussion of test scores in the book, ACT, SAT, and you actually talked to somebody who was paid basically $400 an hour to help kids do test prep, and he doesn't really do test prep,
yeah.
Right? So that was surprising.
Yeah.
What's going on there, and what was he doing instead?
So this is Ned Johnson, who runs his own test prep company in Washington, D.C., called Prep Matters. He's the most sought-after tutor in the D.C. area. And yeah, so for $400 an hour, when I spent a lot of time following him around and watching his testing, his tutoring sessions, and I had this idea that he was just going to be stuffing these kids' heads with as much, you know, algebra and trigonometry as he possibly could. But in fact, he was talking to them much more about stress. And his theory is that when you are the kind of student who would end up in his office, you're going to an excellent school, you have highly educated parents, you have lots of resources, and what's holding you back from getting the test scores you think you need is not a lack of knowledge. It is the anxiety that you feel about this test. A lot of young people, the system trains them to feel that this test is not just something that's going to make or break their future, but it's a measure of their actual self-worth. It's a real, it's a vote on who they are. And so what he does is tries to convince them of the opposite, that these tests are these ridiculous little games. He shows them tricks to, you know, improve their scores.
But you just said they are true, right? I mean, he's trying to convince them the opposite of what your book says is actually true. Am I getting this?
I mean, I feel like what he is arguing is that it is the system certainly puts a lot of emphasis on those tests, but that the tests themselves don't measure something important. So, you know, he says it's a corrupt system, and he understands his role in that system. But he says that if you understand that it's a game, if you understand that you can improve your score by hundreds of points by getting the kind of tutoring that he provides, it doesn't make you believe in the system anymore because you understand that it is, you know, very malleable, very affected by things like test prep. But you stop thinking that it's actually a measure of who you are. I think that puts other kinds of pressure on those affluent students who then start feeling like, well, I'm getting into these schools based not on my own merit, but on the fact that my parents can pay for Ned. And so I think that that is a different kind of stress that they feel, but it's not the kind of stress that Shannon feels.
We talked a lot of numbers so far, and actually I'm going to come back to the numbers in a minute. But in the meantime, really the most compelling parts of the book are where you tell stories. like Shannon's story, there's a number of stories in that book. What surprised you as you had those conversations, and what were the big takeaways for you?
I felt really honored that these young people would share so much of their stories with me. And I think the thing that each story was different, but I think the common takeaway for me was how much young people's feelings about their family and experience of their family was tied up in their feelings about college. I think this is especially true for low-income students, for first-generation students. Going away, especially to a selective institution, if no one in your family has gone to college before, it is just a jarring, strange experience. And it's strange for you, and it's strange for your family as well. You are sort of by necessity when you're experiencing this social mobility. It might be good for you financially, but it's hard to leave behind your family and your culture and your community. And your history, and you're sort of forced in a way that high-income students aren't when they go to selective institutions to encounter a whole new world. That can lead to great opportunities, but it's really jarring as well.
So you don't know this, but you and I have had an argument. And the reason you don't know it is it was all in my head when I was reading the book. But the thing we were having an argument about is you make the case that these elite institutions are important based on future earnings. Mm-hmm. And the piece that I was arguing with you in my head, but we form our children for so much more than that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we educate them and we send them away for life experiences. Are we poor in our metrics of what it means to get a higher education and how we value who our children then go out to be in the world if we're looking so exclusively at income?
For sure. I mean, I ended up with two very different sorts of feelings. I mean, one was on a personal level, spending time at these institutions and looking at this data did not make me particularly eager to have my kids, who are only 4 and 10, so this is a long way off, to have them attend one of these most selective institutions. I feel like what they would gain in the amount that the institution would invest in them, they would lose in being in such an undiverse and elitist kind of institution. The place where I felt much more at home and much more inspired by what I was seeing around me was in public institutions, especially the University of Texas at Austin, where I spent more time than anywhere else. So I do think that there's a lot else that parents and students should take into account when they're choosing institutions. At the same time, though, I think that these institutions, on a social level, these institutions are enormously important as creators of opportunity. And the fact right now that they are so dominated by families and children who already have such privileges and such advantages and so many family resources is a real social problem. And so the fact that MIDS students are going to those schools in such numbers, and students like Shannon, who are every bit as deserving, every bit as smart, every bit as hardworking, are going in such small numbers is a real problem that we need to correct.
All right. That is Paul Tuth, journalist, writer, and author of the new book, The Years That Matter Most, How College Makes or Breaks Us. Paul, thank you for being here.
Thanks very much.
That is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Tisiana Deering. And we hope you will join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.